soprano Benito Valente, who has been celebrated for her interpretation of Lieder, oratorio, and opera. Valente grew up on a farm in California on the edge of the desert. She now lives in Center City, Philadelphia. She studied with Lottie Lehman at the Academy of the West and studied at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia with Marshall Sanger. Benita Valente first received national recognition when she won the Metropolitan Opera audition in 1960. 13 years later, in 1973, she made her debut at the Met in the role of Pamina in Mozart's Magic Flute. She's also sung with the opera companies of Boston, Washington, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Houston, and Montreal, and has been a soloist with the New York Philharmonic, Boston Symphony, Philadelphia Orchestra, Cleveland Orchestra, and the Los Angeles Philharmonic. She lives in Philadelphia with her husband, who is the co-manager of the Marlborough Music Festival in Vermont, where they met in 1958. Benita Valente leaves today for California, where she'll perform in the pre-Olympic gala with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting the Los Angeles Symphony. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Before we talk, I'd like to play a recording that you made a couple of years ago with Richard Good at the piano, and we're going to hear a piece by Mozart. This is Aloisa di Brifa.
Right, Aloisa di Brifa.
Soprano Benita Valente with Richard Good at the piano. Benita Valente, welcome again to Fresh Air. You grew up on a farm in California. How were you exposed to opera living there on the edge of the desert?
Well, we had this nice fat radio that I would twiddle the dials on and find the afternoon broadcast from the Met on Saturday afternoons. And that was my introduction to opera. I didn't really know what I was listening to, but I knew that I enjoyed it very much. And my mother and father both sang. They both had lovely voices. And if I wanted to know the words to any of the melodies that were on the records that we had around the house, my mother would say, well, go ask your father, and he would give me the words. And they turned out to be mostly tenor arias, Caruso, for instance. And he would give me the words. When I got to the Curtis Institute, I knew the tenor repertoire. There were tenors there who were trying to learn it, and they would get mad at me when I'd give them all the words.
So you just transposed it to your range?
Right, because the tenor and soprano range are the same. I mean, it's an octave apart, but I just put it right into mine.
Did when you decided to actually go to Curtis to study singing, did that represent for you a decision to pursue a certain kind of life?
I had always known that I would sing, and I didn't know what the life of a singer was all about. I just knew that if I sang, it would lead me into it. And it would dictate what kind of life I would lead. I chose the Curtis Institute because this fabulous teacher that I had in high school said, "This, if you're serious about singing, this is the course we'll take." And we went to Santa Barbara and worked with Lehman, and he said, "There is the Curtis Institute, and they offer a full scholarship. And if you pass the audition, you can go to school there." And so I just followed along in the plan and ended up in Philadelphia. married to a Philadelphian.
Did it seem like a very competitive field to you? And did that matter?
Well, it's always well known that sopranos are a dime a dozen. There are more sopranos than any other kind of voice. And it's harder to make your way as a soprano because there are so many of us. But I felt that my voice was appealing. And I knew from the first grade that people liked to hear me sing. And I thought that would be my strong point.
Any woman especially, I think, ends up making a lot of trade-offs in her life between career and personal life. What were some of the decisions you've had to make over the years about how far you'd go to pursue a career and how much you'd sacrifice to have what you wanted in terms of a family and personal life?
Well, I never thought about that. I just went along and did what I wanted to do as an individual. I didn't think of it as male or female, or that I might have a hard time because I was a female. Of course, a man can't be a soprano. There's no way to get around that. And the other things that came along were, for instance, when I met my husband and knew I liked him very much, I would not have liked him so very much, I suppose, if he had said, oh, singing, well, I don't know if I want you to do that. I would have just cut it off right then and thought, if he doesn't want that, I don't want him.
You've settled here in Philadelphia. It's not the center of the music world. Has it been inconvenient for you as a singer to be placed here?
Not a bit. I find it very tranquil to be able to get out of, say, New York City and come to Philadelphia and have a peaceful life. I have the feeling that Philadelphians hardly even know that I'm here, which makes it grand for me. I can meet more people who know me on the streets of New York than I do here.
You first won the Metropolitan Opera auditions in 1960. What happened right after that?
I was still in school when I entered those auditions, and right after being one of the winners, I was graduating from the Curtis Institute, and I got a management immediately through Mr. Sanger, who was with someone in New York, and I was kind of passed into safe hands. And I had to audition for all kinds of people in New York. People from all over the world come to New York to hear the singers. And I either passed them or didn't pass them and got jobs here and there. And I felt that it was the kinds of jobs that I was being offered were not so much in opera. I had operatic things, but they were for secondary roles. They were not so much in the kind of operatic things that I wanted to do as they were in, say, oratorio or orchestra. So I decided to move to Germany for 2 years and where I could get into an opera house. And the first season I was there did 8 roles, large and small, and that's in 10.5 months. And I knew by the end of that year that I could get out there and do one of those 8 roles. All I had to do was snap their fingers, and I was there and doing it. And you gain great confidence in doing that.
Were you fluent in German then?
I was not a bit fluent. I learned it as I went. I'm now fluent, but very incorrect.
What do you think of competitions now?
Competitions are, well, it depends on those people who are listening to them. I had entered the Met auditions the year before I was one of the winners and was rather discouraged because I saw people in the finals that I thought I could sing better than and didn't wish to enter the second time around. And one of the people who was one of the judges at the Met asked Mr. Sanger, who was at the time singing at the Met, where is that young Italian girl who sang for us last year? And he said, well, she felt very discouraged. And he said, well, you tell her to enter. And I did. It gave me a little more faith at that point. But it truly, as I have gone along now, I see how it depends on the people who listen. And they're not always, the judges are not always so strong. It's biased according to them. Now, I'm sure that even if I were a judge, there would be people I would pass up. There's no way to like everybody. Pass up who would probably make very good careers.
That same year that you won the Metropolitan Opera auditions, you also recorded a now famous recording with Rudolf Serkin at the piano and Harold Wright on clarinet.
Yes.
of Shepherd on the Rock. Can you tell us about the making of this recording?
Well, I went to the Marlborough Festival because Mr. Sanger was there at the time, and when I discovered that there was all kinds of chamber music, I became interested in that too. Sanger was there to teach us voice and to we were studying roles, and the other part of the school was the chamber music, but I didn't know that when I went there. And that just added another dimension. Okay, go ahead.
What are your memories of that recording session? I think so many people know this record now. Did you have any idea that it would be such a well listened to, appreciated?
No, I'd heard that song when I was in Santa Barbara with Lehman, and when I got to Marlboro, there isn't that much repertoire. And a pianist friend of mine said, "I have a friend who's a clarinetist and would like to do this song." And once I really learned it for myself, fell in love with it, and we just did it over and over, and Mr. Serkin coached me on it and did it with Harold Wright, and that's how it came about. Columbia was there always to record whatever Mr. Serkin wanted to record, and he wanted to do this, and I said to him, "Why?" He said, "Well, because you'll probably never really sound like this again. It's very fresh and enthusiastic, and I'm really, after all these years, still very proud of that recording."
Well, why don't we listen to it? This was recorded in 1960, and this is Schubert's The Shepherd on the Rock with my guest Benita Valente, with Rudolf Serkin at the piano, Harold Wright on clarinet.
Thank you.
The Shepherd on the Rock by Schubert, with my guest soprano Benita Valente, pianist Rudolf Serkin, and clarinetist Harold Wright. That recording was made in 1960. Benita Valente is my guest. She lives in Philadelphia and is about to leave for California, where she will perform in the pre-Olympic gala with Michael Tilson Thomas. Well, the recording that we just heard was made about 20 years ago. How do you think your voice has changed in those 20 years?
It's just filled in. It's like a coloring book that's only got the pictures, the outlines of the pictures, and you take the color and you fill it in. And now I feel that the color has filled into my sound.
Is this something physiological, or is it emotional coloring into?
It's all of that, and it's also the craft of singing, learning how to project the sound and getting it to fill into the resonances.
Is it true that when you're singing opera, your voice improves as it matures?
If you just sing, I think it improves. And I find that going from the leader to the oratorio to the opera, one enhances the other. Opera is very outgoing. You have the whole orchestra to sing across, and you're a great distance from the audience, whereas if you're standing on a leader platform, you're there with your piano, and there's nothing between you and the audience except just a few feet, and you don't feel as if you have to give as much sound. But the sound is better if you know how to manipulate it through all of these phases. And then you don't cut back as you can cut back in the leader, but you can also give out more, and you don't just sing it preciously. You sing it with full-blooded feeling and sound. And the same thing with the opera, instead of just being totally outgoing and bursting your seams trying to get the sound across, you can be a little more flexible with the sound.
How much do you feel the vibrations when you're singing?
A great deal.
Yeah? Where do you feel it?
All throughout. You feel it through your whole body. There's a place in the Marriage of Figaro, which I just did, where the Countess's second aria has some very high and full-volumed phrase that repeats itself. Whenever I get to that point in the aria and I sing it the first time, there are couple of measures before it repeats itself. And I stand there thinking, am I going to fall down? I'm so dizzy. And then it comes by me again, and I do it again, and the whole body seems to settle in. And I make it off the stage, and I'm just fine. I ask myself, why do I get so dizzy? I guess it's just because of so much energy and blood flowing, and the vibration, I think, must create that.
There are times when you're singing in duet with someone and the harmony is so intense that you can just feel it vibrating off each other.
You feel it throbbing between the two of you, and you try to match up that throbbing because that's the vibrato that's going back and forth. And if it clashes, it sounds bad, and if it goes together, it's thrilling.
So do you just kind of naturally find the meeting point on
that? You do, yes. I just did Rinaldo at the Met with Marilyn Horne, and we have a couple of wonderful duets. And we stand very close to one another, and there's just such a rumble coming from both of us that it's almost not even sound that we hear. It is this vibration that we feel.
When you're starting to change that vibrato, can you locate it in your body? Are you changing it in your stomach or in your throat?
You locate it on the sound wave. You feel it going out of you as you make the sound. You're really getting technical now.
Well, I'm just really interested in all of that because, I don't know, physically that kind of singing is so different than the physical nature of say, pop or
mm-hmm.
jazz singing.
Mm-hmm.
And I
it
think
is.
It must be a very different experience for the person performing.
We did the Rinaldos in the Parks, and we had to work off of mics. And I have a couple of arias that are very, very soft, one aria in particular, which is very soft. And I just used that mic. I could feel a sound going out. There were something like 75,000 people. And I just really used it. And I can understand what a pop singer does. I couldn't just stand back and let it vibrate as normally would. I just really tried to sing right into the mic.
When you were creating your career, you were specializing in lieder and in opera, and I think that a lot of singers are advised to choose one area and specialize
well,
in
that. Well, I was always taught both simultaneously, and therefore when it began to get lieder and oratorio heavy on one side, I decided to go to Germany and fill in the side of the opera because I had loved both sides equally and wanted to keep them even and not feel that I was losing confidence in singing opera because I wasn't getting a chance to do enough of it.
And now how do you like to divide your time?
Now it's pretty evenly balanced.
You sing in many different languages. Are you fluent in those languages?
Well, after living in Germany for 2 years, I feel fluent in that language, and I have studied French a long time and can get along in France. I feel all right about singing in these languages, and Italian, of course, was a language we spoke at home. But whenever I'm asked to sing in Russian or any language that I don't know, I feel very off balance and turn it down. I've hardly ever sung in any language that I don't know.
How much do you have to know about a language to feel comfortable that you'll get not only the phrasing right, the pronunciation right, but also the emotional meaning of it?
Well, I feel if you don't understand the words, how can you get the emotional meaning to it? And it certainly doesn't work in a translation. And what we do, we translate unless it's literal. And even then, until you soak it up, you don't. It would be impossible for me to put emotions into words that I don't understand.
What do you think of English translations of operas written in other languages?
If they're very faithful, I feel it's all right. What's difficult is the composer, of course, wrote to the sounds of the words, and when you translate, those sounds are gone. You try to, in the translation, if it's a very good translation, to get some of the same sounds in the same places, same climaxes, so that it feels nearly the same, and you don't have to struggle against it so, because the vocalism is tied in with the words so closely that it's difficult to sing in a translation.
Mm-hmm. You were telling me before that you were very shy when you were growing up. How did you overcome that, which I know you had to do
just
in order to perform on
with
stage?
With practice, well, it started in high school. My voice teacher there, Chester Hayden, who was a wonderful man, led me through my whole career, said that I had to say yes to whomever asked me to sing. And there were all these men's clubs and women's clubs and weddings and funerals and whatever there was in the small town of Delano, California. He said, before you say no, say yes. He says, I know you. He says, you'll say no because you're so shy. So I'd always say yes. And he said, after you say yes, we'll figure out what to do. So by the end of 4 years, I'd been thrown out there so many times. And then, of course, there's the reception afterwards, and people all want to talk to you, and you just have to start getting over this shyness. It's just part of the business.
So practice helped you out?
It was very good for me to be in this business. I don't know what I'd be like now. I was so terribly shy.
There are a lot of stereotypes or cliches about what divas are supposed to be like, and they're supposed to be very temperamental, very self-absorbed.
Well, I've seen some singers who've tried to live up to that. I don't know what comes first, the cart or the horse. I have the feeling with some of them that they don't really have real selves, that they are putting forth this image that they think that the people around them want to see. And I must say, people in high places very often fall for that. If you're just a down-to-earth real person, they think, well, why is the audience going to be turned on by this person? They could, you know, meet anybody in any place that's like this person. They want us to be a little flamboyant when you walk into the room. People have to notice you. I think that people notice you if you feel proud and happy about yourself. You don't have to put on airs.
So do you play that game at all? Do you give the audiences what they want in terms of that flamboyance and ego?
I give the audience me. This is what they get.
Do you think that some people really do put that on because they think it's expected of them?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. And you can tell when somebody's
yes.
doing it?
Yep. I can. The audiences mostly can't.
Do you have any insights into that phenomenon, why audiences want that
they want
kind of overblown
They want something
ego?
Different. They want something that they have in their imaginations. They don't want us to be real people with our feet on the ground.
Do you ever desire to have roles that aren't sopranos? You told us when you were a kid you were saying all the tenor parts because that's what your father sang.
Yeah, well, anytime the music is beautiful, you wish that you were that kind of singer. I've often said, just give me a dramatic soprano voice for a day. I would sing for 24 hours. Give me Birgit Nilsson's or Kirsten Flagstad's voice for a day. And I would sing. They're just wonderful, huge Wagnerian voices. And mine is a nice, light lyric soprano, and you know our repertoires will never cross. And I would love to be able to just push people up against the wall just with the sheer force of the sound of my voice.
What are some of the roles that you'd like the chance to sing someday?
I would love to do Mélisande in Pelléas and Mélisande. That's a Debussy opera. And I will get a chance with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I think it's next season or the following season. We're doing it in concert style. But I certainly would like to do it staged sometime. So that's one of my dreams.
Have you studied acting?
I have, not per se. I mean, I haven't gone to an acting school, but along with the program that we had in Santa Barbara with Lehman, there was an acting teacher, and he happened to be a very fine tenor at the same time, so he could give us, show us what the problem would be in singing and acting simultaneously. He was very good, and I, at that point, thought I was very clumsy. And he said, "You're one of the most graceful people I have ever seen." So that was all I had to hear from then on. I've been graceful.
How does your build and physical looks affect which roles you're going to be cast for?
It affects very much because my voice is caught between a soubrette and a lyric soprano. Say the Marriage of Figaro, I did Susanna for years, now I do the Countess. Così fan tutte, these are both Mozart operas. There's Despina and there's Fiordaligi. I did the role of Fiordaligi because my temperament was such, but voice size, I probably should have been doing Despina. So I get caught between roles. Pamina is a perfect role for me. The role that I did in Rinaldo was also perfect.
There seems to be kind of resurgence of interest in opera in America now. I think in part because of the public television.
Absolutely,
broadcasts.
I feel those Live from the Met things and the telecasts that have come from Europe. There are more and more and more. People can turn on the TV and see this kind of thing. They don't think it's so far away from them anymore.
So can you feel that? Can you feel that there's a change in America's attitude to opera?
I do feel that, yes.
And what do you see there?
Well, I just think it's very good. I love it, so why shouldn't a lot of other people get on the bandwagon?
Opera is the kind of music that people have really strong feelings about, and a lot of people grow up with this anti-opera bias, and
that's right, because
nothing you can do to change
they
it.
Think that there's this shrieking, shrill soprano, and so often, especially men, will come to me and say, "I don't like sopranos generally, but I think your voice is terrific." So, you know, they're used to this kind of what we make fun of, the singer who runs the scales and it sounds so artificial. But that's not what we're all about. I mean, it's theater and the characters are flesh and blood. So I think being able to watch some of that on television has brought it home to them. It's not so far away.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us a little bit about your singing and your life. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you for making it all so easy for me.
And I really enjoy your singing, and I want to
thank you.
My guest has been soprano Benita Valente, who's on her way now to California, where she'll perform in the pre-Olympic gala with Michael Tilson Thomas conducting.
The Beethoven Ninth, by the way.
Would that be televised?
I don't think so. It may be on the radio, but they'll probably tape it.
Right.
It might even be televised. I'm never up on that. I find out everything once I get there.
Well, good luck in California with the convention and the Olympics. It should be real
crazy.
It's
going to be crowded.
I have a good performance there. I want to play another one of your recordings from the album that we opened with Richard Good at the piano. We're going to be hearing a song by Brahms. Why don't I ask you to introduce it?
All right. Der Tod, das ist die kühle Nacht.
Well, I think actually we're
is that the one?
Hearing...
Or we're doing Auf dem Kirchhof.
Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it?
No, just enjoy it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. soprano Benita Valente, accompanied by pianist Richard Good, from an album where Benita Valente performs music by Mozart, Schubert, Brahms, and Wolff. 16 minutes to 4 o'clock, this is Fresh Air, and you're tuned to WHYY 91 FM. In about 20 minutes on today's show, we'll be joined by Kristen Luker, who has written a new book titled Abortion and the Politics of Motherhood, and it's a book that places the current debate about abortion in a historical